Good evening. This is Mimi Poser at the Guggenheim. Prior to the mid-40s, a great deal of the artistic energy in New York City was provided by Europeans. One such artist is Russian-born Ilya Bolotovsky, whose work is the subject of an exhibition currently at the Guggenheim Museum. Mr. Bolotovsky is here with us this evening, as is Grace Brandt Borgenicht. Grace Borgenicht Brandt, of the Grace Borgenicht Galleries, and Dr. Louise Averill Swenson, curator of the Guggenheim Museum. Dr. Swenson was greatly responsible for the preparation of this Bolotovsky exhibition. Good evening and welcome to you all.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Mrs. Brandt, when did you first meet Ilya Bolotovsky?
In 1951, when I first opened my gallery. Or was it before Ilya now?
No, I joined almost a year after you opened the gallery.
Oh, a year after.
More like early 52, possibly. I joined the gallery in 52, I think. Which makes it now a little over 22 years ago.
What was his work like when you first met him?
Just as beautiful as it is now.
I'm listening.
I found it very interesting, exciting. Certainly wasn't au courant at the time. If one could say that there was an au courant, people were not interested in American art at all, which is why I opened the gallery. I wanted to bring American art to the American people and also abroad, but at that time that seemed like a far-fetched dream.
I think we have to explain why we consider Mr. Bolotovsky's art American art, and also say that he was a member of the American Abstract Artists Group. Louise, would you like to say a few words about that?
Well, of course, historically, he came here as a very young person, and he did take some art training at the American Academy, although it was more or less of an academic sort, since he had always drawn and been interested in art ever since he was big enough to grasp a pencil. But during this period, as Grace has said, the Americans were feeling very bereft. The European background, which he mentioned, was heavily dominated during the 30s with the post Picasso group of people, both in Europe and in this country. And also during the 30s, the brand new avant-garde art in Europe was surrealism, which wasn't really imported to this country until the 40s. But Ilya's work carries along a tradition which has been in American art even since the 18th century, an underlying interest in structure of an abstract sort, and not being interested in simply the picturesque, although for a while in the late 19th century you do find something of that tradition. But what's good about American art has been this emphasis on the abstract structure underlying whatever is on the surface. And I think that Ilya grasped this very early, and though he did for a while, if you'll forgive me for saying so, become interested in both very important European artists, Miro and Mondrian, but both of them also were interested in basic form, basic structure. Maybe Ilya can disagree with me on this, but this is what I see looking over the long tradition.
No, I think I'm in agreement. Actually, my main interest was structure, even though the prevailing style in Europe in the 30s was surrealism. It came to this country later. It was picturesque, psychological, fantastic. And this didn't attract me too much. While I was influenced by Mondrian, I was also influenced by Miro. But for me, Miro was not so much a surrealist as a man who structurally composed biomorphic shapes. In other words, my Miro was not a surrealist one, but rather a structural Miro. This type of Miro you find mostly in the 1930s, very fine structure. Later on, it became more of a pseudo-primitive surrealist, rather. Sometimes almost deliberately childlike, where fantasy becomes more important than structure, although, of course, Miro is always excellent.
Well, of course, there doesn't appear to be any fantasy in your work.
Not in
except
this particular
in color.
Sense. Yes, well, that I might say is a inner need. You might question psychologically what is inner need. It sounds like a cliche, and I suppose it is. I think Wöhringer would say it's a volition, which is just another way of calling it inner need. And you might say in plain language, this is what I especially want to do. And it still is pretty much the same thing. You choose to do that which is most important to you. Then you can rationalize later. After many years, you can even develop a certain philosophy. Then you find some philosopher who suits your purposes, but you really weren't following him. You merely picked him as a moral support and a good excuse.
Who is your philosopher?
Well, I like Wöhringer very much, even though when I was doing my work in the beginning, I never heard of Wöhringer. Wöhringer's book came to this country very late. He wrote it in 1906. It was brought here by Wittenborn, I think, in the 50s. And yet in American Abstract Artists, we had discussions which paralleled Wöhringer's in the 30s, without ever knowing Wöhringer, as to whether art should have any elements of nature, or what Wöhringer would say, empathy, or whether it should be purely abstract, or what we call totally non-representational. In other words, using other vocabulary, we had the same conflict in American Abstract Artists group. In other words, Wöhringer came to me as a revelation. I had a very fine art philosopher to support my viewpoint.
I think it's interesting that you and your group were interested in Wöhringer and his principles.
Wöhringer, we didn't know Wöhringer.
But in the principles of Wöhringer without knowing him, and also
discovered.
Artists like Kandinsky and Clay in Europe were reading Wöhringer when he was first published.
Yes, but after all, Kandinsky's work has nothing to do with the abstract ideas of Wöhringer. Kandinsky would consider Wöhringer, but Kassian Kandinsky, I would rather say, as a sort of mystical artist of empathy. And only the latest work of Kandinsky, his geometric work, is more purely abstract. And even then, it's rather explosive and fantastic. And so Kandinsky, who is used as an example of the earliest pure abstraction, does not fit the definition. You can, of course, drop the definition and keep Kandinsky, but if you want to be logical, you must say the earliest abstract artist was not purely abstract. You know, Columbus never discovered America, he discovered some islands. It was Leif Erikson who discovered America. It confused history and art history, too.
Which is standard. Mm-hmm. Mr. Bolotovsky, I'd like to backtrack a little bit, and I would like you to tell our audience a little bit about your early life in Russia and when you first began to study art and how.
My early life in Russia was sort of a typically middle class. I was born in a family of two poor students, which is still middle class in Russia. My parents were university students. My mother went to the only university for women in the whole Russian Empire, the Bestuzhev University for Women. There was only one, which was a great source of pride in Russia because many Western countries had none at all for women, if you know. And she graduated ahead of my father. He was late because he first took up medical courses, then he dropped her for many years, and then he took up law. And so while my mother was working as a bookkeeper, my father went through law school in Petrograd, also teaching women candidates for the Bestuzhev University, teaching them Latin and Greek. And women, it was made sure, would have trouble getting into university because in their high school system, gymnasia, they had no Latin and Greek, and so they couldn't qualify for the university. They had to study that privately, which gave the male students a chance to make a living going to school. My family was so poor that they could only afford one servant. And you couldn't even give her sugar and tea. Now you might say, what sort of poverty is this? But don't forget that Russian poverty, like in Dostoevsky, still included servants. The servant would have coolie wages, and the bosses could be extremely poor themselves. I was born on the Vasilyev Island, which was composed mostly of student and factory workers population in St. Petersburg, which is now Leningrad. And the year I was born, that winter, most of the student children perished. And it was a very severe winter. I guess I'm a survival type. When I was three, we went to the city of Baku, and the family became prosperous. My father was the legal representative of the Nobel Oil Company, and that's where the middle class business began. My great fear as a child was that because of the middle class security, I would never undergo any adventures. Life would be totally still, and we were living on the edge of a volcano. Not only adventures came, some of them horrible ones. I had a most expensive education at that time because the whole empire of Russia had to pay for it and the Tsar's family with their lives to teach me a few facts of life that there is more beyond middle class security. And so this was my life. All the horrors we underwent compared with the future ones for me, is that other people were as nothing after all. So to try to frighten people with my childhood experiences during the revolution is a little bit besides the point. There were millions and millions of others who underwent much worse experiences sometime later.
How did you become interested in art, Ilya?
I drew, I must say, from the age of one. I drew horses, but at first my horses at the age of one consisted only of heads. Then necks were attached, and to the necks were legs, and the legs developed a kind of a guitar-like torsos. And gradually I drew on matchboxes because I felt it was more real, I guess more three-dimensional. Pretty soon I was drawing people at the age of two or so. All this was lost in the revolution. My people I remember were more or less like egg-shaped creatures, and they had no chins. Chins came somewhat later. And they were chinless, it was easier to do it that way. I think by the age of five, I was a pretty good realistic draftsman. I could do portraits.
Your mother encouraged you?
Yes, my mother did. My mother was quite a good artist, self-taught. During the First World War, many artists came from Moscow and Petersburg, the two capitals, and came to Baku.
Who were some of those artists?
Most of them you wouldn't even know. One who was quite a famous fellow is now totally forgotten. His name was Gerasimov. And later on, there was another Gerasimov, a Soviet academic realist. But it's not the same one. The Gerasimov we knew painted very much like Yavlensky, maybe with more violent distortions.
So you got contact with the mainstream of European avant-garde art as a very young child.
We also had publications there. I remember some photographs of early Chagall, when he was quite cubistic.
What was your first formal training in art?
Well, the first formal training was, I'm afraid, in the National Academy of Design, where I think Karl Holtz went, if I'm not mistaken, Arshil Gorky, and many others who prefer not to mention it.
Well, didn't you take some drawing lessons in Russia?
I was strictly with my mother. She had a little art club for a few children.
I remember your mother. She was a very fine painter and always interested.
So you grew up
wonderful.
In a kind of art milieu where art was, I have to remember that so many Americans in what we call a middle class environment grow up with no contact with art whatsoever, even reproductions.
Well, when I asked this question, I was thinking in particular of a story that Mr. Bolotovsky has already told us about when you went to school in Constantinople, I think it was, and you studied with some monks.
Oh, yes. Well, I'll get to this. I remember in our apartment in Baku, we had reproductions of paintings by Böcklin.
Oh.
And I thought they were rather gloomy, and I still think so. But still,
you should.
Böcklin now is respected more than he was in between. At that time he was. Later he was forgotten. Now he, thanks to Kiriko's connection, he is up again. And actually he's quite a fine artist.
There's been some very good shows of his recently.
Yes. Some of the other artists I don't quite remember. Of course, we had reproductions and books of artists like Serov, Levitan, Repin, and so on. Vrubel, who is not known in this country, was an excellent pre-surrealist, and he's totally unknown here. We even had some exhibitions in Baku. Baku had its own opera and theater, but art exhibitions happened very seldom outside of this art studio founded by runaway artists. Now, the reason the artists came from the two capitals to Baku was this. The Caucasus was considered to be populated by rather disloyal elements, the Tartars, the Mountaineers, and others. And so the draft came to the Caucasus last of all. And artists who wanted to avoid a draft would flee to Baku and stay there, kind of become
modern
rather
gray. Canada, what?
It was their Canada, yes, if you like. And so we had quite a great artistic life there as a result of the First World War for a while.
But this was all missing after you and your family escaped from Russia and got to Constantinople.
There was no art
environment there other than the historical remains of
That's
the churches
right.
and mosques and so on.
Oh, yes. No, in the French college run by the brothers, they taught art. The fellow who taught us art knew nothing about art, and I thought the course was stupid. We had to do geometric figures with a charcoal crayon where nothing could be erased. They had to be precise geometric figures, circles and so on. They had to be perfect and properly, not exactly shaded, but done in passages, what Malevich calls passages, gradual from light to dark. I was the only one who could do it, and I thought it was silly. But actually, years later, I went back to this type of work.
So maybe this monk, it's very good training.
The monk who was no artist at all, in a sense, influenced me, in a way.
You mentioned Malevich, and I'm curious to know, were you aware of any of the work of the constructivist and suprematist artists like Malevich and Rodchenko and Tatlin at the time that you were in Russia?
Very vaguely. But I was more impressed with people like Vrubel, much more dramatic. But when I came to this country, sometime in the 20s, there was a big show of Russian art arranged by a man called Brenton. It was a very big show, and at that time, Russian art officially was still avant-garde, although it was already repressive in Russia. So the show arranged here represented Russian art as being very avant-garde. Our idea of Russia is always a bit behind the times. And this show was very inclusive. It was a fantastic show, and the man is totally forgotten who arranged it, and I would like to trace him somehow. His name was Brenton. He was a friend of Burluk, David Burluk.
Mm-hmm, yes.
Burluk is dead, I can't ask him. And Brenton is dead, he was old at the time.
Find some young art historians.
Well, if anyone
in
the audience is anybody knows wants where to he tackle is. This.
And that made a big impression on you.
Yes, that was actually so. And that was way before I saw my first Mondrians. In other words, there was some influence on me by the work of the Russian suprematist constructivists. It was a rather vague thing, but some years later, in 1933, I saw the Mondrians and also the Miros. Of course, before then, I had a chance to see the Picassos. If you remember, New York had very few art galleries at the time, yes. And there were none outside of New York. The art world was small, the national academies in each big city had total monopoly with their annuals. As a matter of fact, I exhibited it myself.
Would you say that Mondrian, excuse me, yes. Would you say that Mondrian was the biggest influence on you?
In the end, yes, that's right.
I'm curious, you've remained very much in the tradition of Mondrian in the construction of your paintings, but have deviated enormously in the color. Mondrian, as everyone knows, stayed with gray, white, and the red, blue, and yellow, and you have a very varied palette, certainly not in any sense a limited palette.
Oh no, my palette is very limited. It's an illusion. If you analyze the color schemes, they're very much reduced. They're supposed to create a feeling of many, but it's done with very few colors. The most I might allow myself is to use two different kinds of reds or two different kinds of blues, but it's
well, I didn't mean
colors.
To imply in a single painting. I meant in your all over work.
He means he never used green.
I don't use green, and I avoid.
Well, that you've adhered to Mondrian. However, you've used purples and shades and.
Well, that was during the previous times, not anymore.
Not recently.
Not recently, no, that's out.
But there's some where the combinations of colors border on the purple.
I mean the
magenta.
Oh, well, this, yes. Well, that's an important point. You see, Mondrian worked very hard to avoid color vibration. Because if two colors clash with each other, you get the effect of a third one, which amounts to the average of the two different color waves from each color. What you see then, let's say between an orange red and a yellowish green, in between you see a golden color, which is almost yellow, which is the average wavelength. This is what Mondrian avoided, because for him, each color had to be a final statement. You see, it had to be pure in itself and final, and this occasionally I allow myself to do, where a color is allowed to look different because of the effect of other colors. You see, in other words, here our philosophies change a bit. We are not quite entirely parallel. I think in the same fashion, I think Leger tried to keep each color as much as possible intact. Well, if you take people like Matisse, his colors affect each other deliberately. And sometimes you can't quite tell what each one is until you see them separately. It's a different approach. In other words, one is where the colors keep on changing and create a richer effect. The other is the effect of finality, which really is a pure effect. I would say this, that in my style is, I allow myself a little more freedom, maybe than the Mondrian type of work requires, but my personality is different, and so I simply have to have this elbow room. This is deliberate, of course. Now, in the last two paintings of Mondrian's, where he had colors side by side, he worked very hard to avoid color vibration. Of course, it's rather easy to achieve it, and I see why we should work so hard. If you have blue and yellow vibrating, you stop the vibration by making, let's say, blue extra dark and yellow extra pale. Once the values are different, the vibration practically stops. if the values are close, the vibration is intense, and you see the effect of one color on the other. Yellow, for example, will absolutely bleach the blue, just like blueing in a laundry.
Why have you come back to the use of the primary colors?
Oh, I had the need of doing something of a sort of final statement instead of using the more of accidental, fortuitous effects, which keep on changing, so there's nothing permanent. One effect is very rich, but it's like walking on a swamp. The other is solid ground. Again, it's a certain, I would say, volition, according to Waringer or Kant, or it's an inner need to establish a certain finality. Relative, of course, nothing is final.
Well, one way, of course, that you've differed from Mondrian is the use of different shaped canvases. The tondo, or the circular canvas, and the diagonal, mm-hmm. although Mondrian did use diagonals,
he used
never as much with so great variety as you use them today. In your particularly, well, you've always used them, let's say, since the 50s, early 50s, but you use them quite naturally often today. I wouldn't. Mm-hmm. I don't know a numerical count, but it's a high percentage. Diagonals.
Well, the reason for my tondos, the circular canvases, is rather funny one. Actually, you know, not everything happens logically. A lot of things happen through accident. An accident happens. You like it, you do it, and then finally you rationalize about it. I visited a certain rancher in Wyoming, and he had some wagon wheels, and he gave me one as a gift. And I removed the spokes, and I stretched canvas on it, and I realized that it's a very pleasant shape and has many possibilities.
Is that the one that's first?
That's the one in the show.
That belongs to Mrs. Solomon, yes.
No, that's the one. Except now it's taken off the wagon wheel.
He took it off.
It was
so frightfully
heavy.
I was so upset to find it was off.
No, it was frightfully
so
heavy.
So nice to have a wagon wheel.
You couldn't hang it on a wall. It would rip the plaster off. You had to pop it up. But it was an extremely heavy wagon wheel. And so then I realized that tondo shape offers new possibilities. A straight line inside a tondo, for example, tends to be pulled away from the edge. And since you have round edges on either side, the straight line is tense like a string, pulling either one way or the other way, and you have a new effect almost of a tense, vibrant string, which in a rectangular canvas you do not get. So it's a new element. To my mind, a circle is a completely final shape in itself, after all, a perfect circle is. And then, of course, you might criticize the ellipses, which there's endless variety. An ellipse really is a circle with two centers, so I consider it still a rather final shape. The rhombs I generally use are equal to two equilateral triangles, so there's a finality by them. In other words, by finality, I mean a certain logical order, and not purely an accidental shape. I'm not criticizing the accidental shapes or proportions, but they belong in the emotional paintings of empathy. Such a thing would be very well for Pollock, who painted in an explosion of feeling, and deliberately disguising all structure, because that would look like cool calculation, and it would interfere with the emotion. In other words, for Pollock to show geometric structure inside his work would make you feel that this fellow is not really full of emotion, he's calculating, and his feeling is false. Now, and so he deliberately avoided this.
Well, your canvases don't have the feeling of calculation. They have a feeling of rightness and naturalness and richness.
Would you say you're an intuitive painter rather than planning everything before using tapes?
Combination, I suppose, of both.
I would say both. I know one painter, Anton Gerlot, who reduced all his paintings to mathematics and his three-dimensional work too. And towards the end of his life, he told Jose de Rivera, this is nonsense. He realized that he really composed intuitively, and then he rationalized because it fitted mathematically, but really through his intuition. He was a good mathematician. It all fitted well, but his mathematics really was a rationalization of his intuitive feelings. So it was both, really. He composed intellectually, but without the intuition, it's just dry, and vice versa. Without the intellect, the intuition becomes purely emotional and rather romantic or expressionist.
We have just a few minutes left, not really even a few minutes. I would like you to give us your definition of neoplasticism.
Well, I would say it's not any different from Mondrian's, and so I would not want to distort anything the master said, because he was the purest neoplastic artist, and you can't go beyond him. You can do other things. And neoplastic art is an art which is based on neutral elements of tension and balance, which requires the elements to be straight lines, because a tense line is a straight line. In other words, it's not so much straight lines, but tensions. When the string is very taut, it's straight. It's not really hard edge. It's just a taut composition. It has no shapes except what results from a right angle relationship. But these are not exactly shapes, they're just spaces. The intense color spaces might be considered as positive spaces, which in a very remote way corresponds to, let's say, objects. The areas which are more neutral in color, gray, white, or weaker colors, might be considered negative spaces, which are not backgrounds, because the background is far away once and for all. A negative space may be either flat, or it may be slightly in front or slightly back, depending on the optical illusion. And so there is room for a play back and forth on the canvas, very slight. And so that it's an art of a positive, negative, neutral relationships of tensions and balances. The result is to achieve a perfect, an attempt to achieve a perfect art of harmony and balance that gives it the effect of a certain eternal solution. Now, of course, there is no such solution in life. This is merely an attempt. Any such final solution would mean that you paint one picture and that's the end of it. You can't paint anymore. So I would say it would be like with Sisyphus, it would be an endless approach to such a solution. And so you can paint because you can never succeed totally, but the approach is on a human level absolutely sufficient, I would say. Luckily for us, that you can never totally succeed.
Thank you very much. Louise, would you remind our audience when they will be able to see this exhibition at the Guggenheim Museum?
It opens on Friday morning, September the 20th, and closes on November the 10th.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ilya Bolotovsky, Grace Borgnick-Brandt, and Louise Averill Svensson, for having been with us this evening. And to our audience, good night and thank you.